This is how you fight, by building, because the people who create that culture, they are chopping the branch on which they stand.
Right.
So for thousands of years, people had to figure out ways to organize their behavior in order to survive the pretty shitty Dark Ages. Not only the Dark Ages, but history in general.
Right.
Was pretty shitty up until recently. Mm. It's very difficult to organize a large amount of people in a sustainable way that leads to progress and not to death.
Mm-hmm.
And so although that culture definitely has many bad aspects, throwing it away without having anything better to offer is suicide, because you're burning down the house which you dislike while still living inside that house, while still depending on that house. And this is like being on a deathbed, being terminally ill in a hospital, severely ill in a hospital, and you have all these tubes going in your body, sustaining your life. And you're like, well, these medications and these medical devices are imperfect. Mm. Let's burn them all down while you still depend on them. This is what happens. Everybody dies if you continue with that rhetoric.
Bringing complex ideas down to earth, based on their value, not group identity. This is The Daily Archetype.
If you want someone to remain ignorant, just make sure they think in groups of identity rather than groups of values. Let's promote understanding, not ignorance.
This is The Daily Archetype.
What's up, archetypal friends? I'm your host, Isaac J. Miller, here on the only podcast that's constantly rediscovering our innate archetypal value structure. I think you guys will really enjoy this episode. Sorry I didn't publish it a little bit sooner. I've been dealing with Clubhouse addiction. Definitely get on that app. Maybe before I get over the addiction soon, I can actually send a couple invites if people hit me up and ask nicely. But it is only on iPhone, by the way. So this episode with Marin, the Dr. Ironbrain, we talked about a book that's one of my new favorite books, Factfulness by Hans Rosling. But it was more inspired by that, so we could get into all kinds of other issues. I actually want to do a video on the book here in the next week or so, where I can just get more into the nitty-gritty details of the book. And I'll also leave information about how to see some of the videos on it, and of course, get the book if you're interested in it. We talked about all kinds of phenomena in the brain and our instincts, such as confabulation, which is your brain just needing to put out a coherent story, even if it's BS. We talked about lobotomies. We talked about if the current school system or education system is making people, especially men, into weaker human beings than what we used to be. We spoke about how having children may be the most direct path to heroism. And where have all the heroes gone anyway? You don't really hear about those anymore. Real day-to-day heroes. Honor and brotherhood got replaced with narcissism and traitors, which is a lesson from the gulags. The true enemy is not some dark lord. Rather, the traitors are the sellouts among us. And the line between good and evil that runs down the heart of every single person. So the real traitor or hero is inside of everyone. Please continue to support. Find us on all the social media. Now in Clubhouse at Daily Archetype. Trying to get things to the next level by the summer when I have the 1-year anniversary for the show. So please support. Stay tuned for that. Check out the show notes for more information. And please enjoy the episode.
Welcome to the Daily Archetype, a value-sharing community.
I am recording live with Marin, Dr. Ironbrain. And today he has on his white coat with his teal doctor shirt under that. And he's like,
looking like a really official doctor person. So we appreciate that. So how's it going today, official doctor person?
Today was a pretty official doctor day.
What did you do that was so official doctory?
I did official doctor stuff.
Wow, good for you. So Marin is a guy who appreciates a person who I have come to appreciate recently, who put out really awesome books shortly before he unfortunately passed away a few years ago. But this book is surprisingly amazing to me, mainly because it gets into this issue of 10 instincts that confuse us. And the reason that's really fascinating to me is because I feel like these instincts get into so much of the issues why it's not like necessarily the media's fault or the president's fault or foreigners' fault or anybody else. It's our human nature, why that we are so dumb sometimes and so ignorant. The book is called Factfulness, and it's really cool. It includes a bunch of charts and things about world health, and I won't show too much of that because we're going to probably mainly have people listening rather than viewing. But Marin, I just gave you the video link to look this over, and you are like a fan of Hans Rosling, from what you said. So just tell me a little bit of your initial impression of this subject matter.
I got interested in the subject matter many years ago. I was still a student, and I read one famous book on cognitive behavioral therapy. The book is named Feeling Good, The New Mood Therapy, and the author is David Burns. So that book is written for treating depression, anxiety, stuff like that. However, the initial chapters opened my mind for the first time for cognitive distortions and later on logical fallacies. And I was amazed that our minds can distort reality in such profound ways.
Right.
In order to cause suffering in our daily lives.
Right.
But similar distortions seem to distort our view on reality in general. And I see that a lot of political unrest is motivated behind such distortions.
Right. And I just have to get this off my chest. When you bring that up, there's this thing kind of being like a pet peeve or like something bothering me recently is when I hear people say things like feeling brain versus thinking brain. And I thought that you'd be a good person to clarify that, because for the most part, what they're trying to get at is put it in like layman's terms or dumb it down to like, you know, the unconscious, subconscious, or left brain, right brain. But as people like you and I, who are kind of like nerds for this stuff, we're like, it's not feeling versus thinking brain. So what is your interpretation of the feeling brain versus the thinking brain? And what are maybe some terminologies that you might use to better describe that division?
I would call it instinct versus thinking.
Okay.
I will elaborate. So even the stupidest person is pretty smart in certain regards.
Right.
Because we evolved for millions of years.
Mm-hmm.
And we evolved these gut feelings to serve as heuristics, as rules of thumb.
Right.
And it seems that although some people cannot explicitly and rationally explain why they reached a certain conclusion, we shouldn't throw their gut feelings out so easily. We shouldn't discard them so easily. The problem comes when these gut feelings which we evolved are not applicable to the current environment, because we live in an evolutionary mismatch. The environment today is very different, vastly different compared to the environment before. And some of our heuristics are now not adaptive. They can mislead us.
This gets into some of the things that we talked about when we had a podcast a few weeks ago, and also some of the things that you talked about on your TED Talk and some of the other videos that you had, where like Hans Rosling is really big on his, what I think he calls it, like his battle against ignorance. But it's more than ignorance, because what he's finding is when he would ask people, you know, simple multiple choice questions about like how the world's doing, how we are in terms of females in primary education, how many years that they've spent, you know, compared to males, how that we're doing in terms of population, babies per woman, and the trends of those things. Almost everybody in every situation would get those questions vastly wrong. And it's not just because they're getting it wrong. It's because they're misinformed, because they're being fed a narrative that the world is like doom and gloom and it's the apocalypse and everything's coming to an end, which made sense maybe 50 years ago or more. But people don't want to believe that now things are actually improving. And what I find amazing is that he was out there preaching this stuff since the 90s, but people are still like, no, we need to have like the apocalypse message and hellfire message. And it's like the end of the world kind of message for everybody. And people refuse to believe it. So it's bigger than ignorance. It's like a fantasy of doom and gloom. So is that something that you've seen, or what has been your impression of that as you've come across this information?
Some things are getting better.
Mm-hmm.
Many other things are getting much worse.
Mm-hmm.
And those aren't reported.
Right.
Those aren't politically correct.
Right.
So I don't think that it's a fantasy that certain important things are getting worse.
Mm-hmm.
Because there is a reason why people are getting more unhappy.
Right.
Something which we call the paradox of modernity.
Mm.
It's a paradox because modernity...
Mm.
Has brought a tremendous amount of material comfort.
Right.
And modernity has lifted the burden of disease and suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, subjective well-being is declining.
Right.
Mental illness is increasing rapidly. Mm-hmm. It has reached pandemic proportions.
Right.
Drug abuse, alcohol abuse is also on the rise. So it seems that although the world is getting better,
mm-hmm.
people are feeling worse.
This is why that in this book, and there's a couple other books similar to this, I recently read The Rational Optimist, which is similar. That's The Evolution of Prosperity. About a year ago, I read Enlightenment Now by Steven Pinker, which are sort of similar. And they will at least mention that fact. But the problem with that fact, as far as things getting worse in those regards, is those are so much harder to quantify and figure out the what and the why, and especially in a politically correct manner, like you mentioned. Whereas the things like population and health and all those things, they're not only easier to quantify to actually see them on the data, but they're easier to quantify on seeing what data brings those about, which is basically as we raise the standard of living in particular areas, then they get healthier and their population stabilizes and everything else. But you're right. Then we come into other problems, which is that of subjective well-being, happiness, mental illness, even substance abuse. And that might have to do more with, like, when I think of the feeling brain versus the thinking brain or instinct, as you put it, you're right. But I think it's even deeper than that, which is almost like the symbolic brain is our right brain, or metaphor, or almost even religious brain, in that it's trying to connect to deeper things, bigger things. And then it comes across as we connect through instincts and we feel it as feelings. So it seems like our feeling brain. But what puts us in this predicament is people aren't connecting to anything in that sort of symbolic realm or that deeper realm, or sometimes it's called the meaning crisis. People are very disconnected from things that are deeper, that all that they do is like, it's so especially when it's so easy to survive, that kind of causes that existential issue. Cause it's just like, you have to do almost nothing and you're going to survive. So you've got almost nothing to worry about. So since you've got nothing to worry about, you just kind of like float through life rather than having to like strive for it. And then you have to like connect even on a deeper psychological, religious even level. But now it's just like you have to exist, and no matter what, you're almost for sure going to, or the chances are, I should say, that you're going to die of old age. And so that kind of like puts us in this sort of existential trap rather than the striving toward survival and creating a family and having them survive and everything else. But what do you think?
despite certain markers of well-being increasing, we also see that chronic disease is increased tremendously in the last century.
Mm-hmm.
So people are living longer, but they are also sicker. We've decreased the burden of infectious disease for sure after antibiotics.
Right.
But we've increased the burden of chronic disease. And this isn't only because people live longer, that they live to reach a certain age where chronic disease is common. So the father, Sir William Osler, who was the father of internal medicine, if I remember correctly, he only saw a few cases of heart attacks in his entire career. Okay, think about that. So that's something to think about. So in the year 2000, up to 30% of people who qualified for a psychiatric diagnosis, I would think that today they are even more. Well, we can discuss the issue of psychiatric overdiagnosis, but even that, taking into account, 30% is quite a lot. And you said the meaning crisis. That is true, because well, man does not live on bread alone. We have a lot of bread. We eat too much grains. We are fat and sick. But we don't have connection to a higher purpose. People are going to laugh in your face, especially the intellectual rationalist type of people, when you are discussing the higher purpose. You know, I recently met a fundamentalist Christian for the first time in my life, because in my country is pretty atheistic.
Okay.
Extremely atheistic, to the point that there is almost no discussion about religion, either in school or in the media. Nobody talks about that. It's as if it doesn't exist.
And so you met a fundamentalist Christian in person recently?
Yes.
So how'd that go?
It went pretty well. It went pretty well, to the point of me wishing that I could believe in the world ontology, because he's happy, he's healthy, he has purpose. He has extreme self-discipline. He is intelligent. He has a stable relationship. They are going to get married. He is going to have five children. And his wife has a common purpose. He has 20 people around him whom he can trust his life with.
Wow.
I mean, that sounds like a recipe for a pretty good life. How many people live a life like that today?
The minority, for sure. It's hard to say what how many there are, but, or at least the minority in the modern world. And see, that's kind of like getting into our, you know, subject is that, and by the way, Hans Rosling, he doesn't, like, we often use words like modern or developed and developing. I don't know if the terms that he uses will be adapted enough, or maybe if they should be given more contemporary context, but he likes to put it into four levels, just because there's a huge difference between the levels. And it's not just like the modern and the developing or whatever. It's he puts it into four levels. But the reason is because the majority of the world isn't in this like poor could die any day level, and they're not in the like American level. They're somewhere in between. And so probably the majority of the modern world, or people, you know, to use that terminology, but people in the rich countries, will say, are on some level in the meaning crisis, however conscious they may or may not be of it. Whereas people in the developing world, although they have less access to modern things like transportation and internet on a regular basis and those kind of things, they have more meaning. And a lot of it is just because they're striving for survival and keeping their family happy and everything else. But also they're usually more religious and connected to their religion. And then I will say too, the big thing about religion is that it is the issue of having a higher power, because like I was reading another book that is kind of bugging me because he uses, I don't know, just like dumbed down terminology. But one of his things is like, we have this moral gap instinct where we, like, if you get punched in the face, you automatically think that there's this injustice. Or on the other hand, if somebody just like gives you a house, there's this good injustice. But that's assuming that everybody is generally human beings all on, you know, this like level of having to say some are better than others or worse than others. Where on the other hand, if you have a religious perspective, then you realize none is good but God or, you know, the higher power. And so then if you have a really bad day or someone treats you unjustly or malevolently, as, you know, Dr. Peterson might say, then it's not like, oh, there's a horrible person. You just understand it as that's a person going through life and it's unfortunate that they need to do that. And so then it puts us less in this position of like needing justice. It's the meaning crisis is a big thing. And having that situation heightens a lot of our instincts, or, you know, puts a lot of our instincts off, because in our history, we've always been religious societies up until recently. So
we still are.
Yeah, we still are, but we're unconscious about it. But yeah, go ahead.
Religion has been replaced by
other religion.
Party.
Right. Right. And the big thing with that is you're absolutely right, but people deny it because they treat their wokeism or their scientism or their left or right or center or extreme whatever thing as religion, but then they deny it, usually while they're like persecuting religious people, but they're behaving in a religious way. And so then that's like expounds the meaning crisis. Or on the other hand, then there's other people that are nihilistic, but then that puts them in this position where they're just living a life of suffering and they don't know why. Any other thoughts? And then we can try to get into some of these instincts that Hans mentions.
Yes, I have quite a few notes on the video which you sent me, and it's nice to discuss those.
So let me just run over these instincts really quick, and then we can see if you want to dive into any or all of them in the time that we have. There's the gap instinct, the negativity instinct, the straight line instinct, the fear instinct, the size instinct, the generalization instinct, the density instinct, the single perspective instinct, the blame instinct, and the urgency instinct. So I sent you a video that kind of briefly went over those, or in like about an hour with his son, Ola Rosling. So yeah, are there any of those that you want to jump into?
All of those were evolutionarily adaptive.
Right.
Generalizations work when the environment does not change much.
Right.
You know, when you see that the grass is moving in a certain way, that most probably is a tiger or the wind.
Right.
Or the winds, but it pays to be wrong. Then it pays to be wrong 100 times, but be right one time, a single time. Then to be right all the. I mean that if you miss the tiger, you're dead.
Right. And then there go your genes with you, unless you had some babies before that.
Yeah, of course. So jumping to conclusions, that negativity bias and other generalizations also work.
Mm-hmm.
Also revolutionarily adaptive. The problem is that the modern world is very complex.
Right.
First thing. And we actually in evolutionary, in ancient times, in Paleolithic times, we observed the world with our own senses.
Right,
we gathered information. Our instincts were evolved to help us reach decisions based on information which we directly perceive with our senses.
Right
now, we do not.
We're living in a world of abstraction.
We live of a world of no. We do not receive information from our senses directly, but rather we receive secondhand information from a screen, from someone who decided what to tell us, and we also have a bubble on what we search online.
Yeah, well, this is true, but even pre-internet age, you know, like maybe when we're growing up, our world has become completely social. You know, because before it was like, can you go like catch a rabbit and find some mushrooms and berries and, you know, in our sort of hunter-gathering sort of theory of evolution. But now the only thing that's going to make a difference in you surviving like that isn't your ability to get rabbits and berries or whatever. It's your ability to have that through information and people. And so you're right that it's all through like screens and everything. But even aside from screens, it's this weird social environment that it's harder to connect to that. And we're like disconnected from it because it's and we don't all understand how to connect to the social world or psychological world the same way. So that puts us in a really weird position.
Here is the problem with the psychological world.
Okay.
During most of our evolution, we lived with the same 30, 50, 150 max people in the tribe. Everybody knew each other.
Right.
And during most of our evolutionary history, we never actually met other tribes. That started happening relatively recently.
Right.
So people never knew that other people exist. The names, many modern tribes, the name of the tribe is translated in their own language as the people.
Mm-hmm.
So think about that. Every person that exists, at least in your mind, you know them. So compare this to the modern, to today, where when you commute to work, you may meet hundreds, if not thousands, of strangers. That we never did that before in our evolutionary past, because when you meet a stranger, usually two things would happen. You'll get killed or you'll get raped.
Or you have to be on the other side of that, doing the killing or raping.
Yeah, of course. Later, we discovered the value of cooperation and trade.
Right.
So how do we adapt to that? When you pass someone on the street, when you're walking past someone on the street, you act as if they do not exist. You do not look them in the eye.
Right.
You do not engage in any way, as if they are trees, as if they are inanimate objects. And that's pretty weird. Imagine two wild animals meeting each other in the wild and not making eye contact or not engage in any way. That's pretty weird. And that escalates when you're in the bus and someone steps on your toe. And then you're forced to interact and aggression breaks in.
Right. In another book I just finished recently, The Rational Optimist, and I was wondering if you heard this kind of information when I read it, is that I'd have to look it up to get the exact numbers, but I think he said it's believed, and this book was from 2010, but he said it's believed now that there is a genetic marker for people who have a more optimistic mindset. It comes down largely genetically, and then other people can, on the other hand, have a more pessimistic mindset, and that comes down genetically. And he said it's something like, I believe, 80-20. So like about 20% of people are naturally more optimistic, and something like about 80% of people are naturally more pessimistic, which kind of makes sense to what you were saying a few minutes ago, how optimism doesn't, especially in the hunter-gatherer evolutionary theory, it doesn't pass down genetically as well as pessimism. Although now it's a strange world because, you know, people aren't getting killed by things in the natural environment hardly anymore, by lions or whatever. We get killed by infectious diseases or cancer or heart attacks or things like that, or sometimes accidents. Have you heard of these things as far as the genetic availability of optimism versus pessimism naturally?
It makes sense. Some psychological traits like neuroticism are heavily genetically determined, and these people experience negative feelings strongly. They are more prone to pessimism, depression, stuff like that. So it makes sense. It was adapted in some point in the past.
Right.
It helped their ancestors survive. Right. I think that let's entertain a thought for a second. In the modern world, being more pessimistic may be a hindrance, because there are so many things now to cause anxiety. You just need to open your phone in the morning and the news will bombard you with things which can lead to despair, nihilism. You may just want to give up because everything, not everything, but that a lot of things are going wrong. I think that this may select for more optimistic people to survive nowadays, because they'll be more resistant to that bombardment with negative information.
Like what he talks about is the in the book is the negativity instinct, and that's almost like a pessimism. And again, the reason I think these are important is because, and he again talks about it in the book and his lectures, how we can't just blame the media, and but they get a part of the blame. But I think what we figure out in these instincts is, you know, this is human nature, and the media does what they do because of human instinct. And we as media consumers and, you know, political consumers and everything else, and just material consumers, we just like the random masses all behave in a certain way because of these instincts. And this all is working and perpetuating because of these instincts that are built into us. And the reason these are important too is to not just always be like, it's the media's fault or it's the politician's fault. It is partly that, but it's also just the way that human nature is. And the more that we understand the way that human nature is, then the more we can understand and start to you know, solve these problems. Like a lot of the book too is just about better understanding the way the world is in terms of improving in some ways and getting worse in other ways. And so if you understand the world the way that it really is, then you can see what we're doing well and what's not working, and then how to fix it rather than living in a strange self-imposed nightmare or delusion. But yeah, if we're living in this like negativity bubble, then we get the illusion that we're doing the wrong things when a lot of what we're doing is the right thing. In like an evolutionary environment, it's good to like always be neurotic and afraid because anything could kill us in the environment at the time. But now it's kind of the opposite. Like almost nothing can kill us, but things can kill us mentally, which I think is what's going on, is as far as this, you know, mental illness issues and everything. We're staying alive, but there's all this negativity bombarding us, and we're just so detached because we're getting all the negativity that the world's ending when physically it's not. So that makes us more detached because we feel like our instincts are wrong. We're like intuiting or are having the instinctive feeling that our instincts are wrong, which is correct. Our instincts are wrong. So what's your other thoughts or other notes on these?
In certain ways, the world is ending though.
Yeah.
At least in the West, mm-hmm. birth rates are plummeting.
Mm.
Testosterone levels in men are plummeting, which leads to mental illness,
mm-hmm.
which leads to weird behavior.
Right.
It leads to weakness in weak people make very bad decisions, especially
right.
politically. Mental illness, as I said, is on the rise. Substance abuse is on the rise. Chronic disease is on the rise. People do not want to have children. Many things are getting worse. And there is not a single European country which has birth rates above the replacement level. Apparently something is going on, and this is unsustainable long term.
Right. One interesting thing about America is that we're very like 50-50 on everything, including the religion thing, in that about 50-50 people are some sort of atheist, and the other 50% some sort of religious person or believe in God on some level. Although, you know, it's give or take. But the reason that's interesting to what you just said is that in America for a long time, the birth rates were plummeting, but now for at least a few decades, they've been a little above the replacement level. They've been like at 2.3, I think. So I don't know if we can surmise that might be because we have some religious values or some religious in or religion still in our culture, but I don't know. Why do you think that might be as far as the difference between America and Europe in birth rates?
I can answer the question pretty easily, but I would like not to do it on your show.
Okay. Can you answer complicatedly or should we just skip that?
I don't want neither me nor you to get into trouble.
Okay. Yeah, we don't want to get canceled today. So, All right, so we can talk about some of these other instincts. So some of these other ones are that we can talk on at least briefly is there's the straight line instinct, which is there's this instinct, and this goes a lot into some of the population fears that we've been dealing with the last few decades is that people are like, oh no, the world's getting more populated, and so it's always going to get more populated. But it's actually almost definitely leveling out to where people are on average having just about the 2 babies per woman, in some areas slightly less, like Europe, and some areas a little bit more. So we're going to level out somewhere between 10 and 11 billion sometime this century. But what happens is people sort of like have this instinct that if things are on an upward trajectory, it's going to go on an upward trajectory forever. And if things are getting worse, they're going to get worse forever, when it doesn't usually work that way. Is there anything you can say about that as far as people having that sort of like, if it's doing this, it's always going to do this kind of instinct?
When we say it's always, It makes sense to compress time to the limits of our own lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
Because this is what we care about. Mm-hmm. And maybe our children, so that our genes survive.
Mm-hmm.
First thing. So things may improve in the future.
Right.
They may not. You don't know. You want things to be good now. So when we say always, or when we think that things are always going to be bad,
right,
actually, in that all, if that always is the short term, which affects our own lives directly, it makes sense. The second thing is that if you really believe that things are going to always get worse, that may lead to urgency to act.
Right.
So that is, again, adaptive compared to someone who says, well, yeah, things are bad now, they may improve in the future, and that person dies, and his gene died too, because he didn't act as urgently, and he wasn't that motivated to act.
Right.
It's something like the religious story of that bad things are coming, prepare now. It helps, it's adaptive.
Yeah, in the book, Hans told this story about when he met Al Gore on a number of occasions, because, you know, Al Gore was always like the preaching the apocalypse of climate change. And there may be some truth to that. And that's definitely something to take seriously. But Al Gore, every time that he would get a chance to speak to Hans Rosling at these speaking events that they would have on, you know, global health and such things, Al Gore would always, and, you know, Hans would be like, I really respect the guy, and I'm so glad that he did, you know, this and this and this to raise awareness on these issues. But he would always like corner me and tell people and tell me to like use my graphs and my information and my talks to illustrate the worst case scenarios, because that's the only way that we can get people to do what they need to do. And Hans would be like, no, we should not do that, because then when things don't go that worst case scenario, because that's likely, because if they do go the worst case scenario, then, well, we're doomed, but it probably won't go the worst case scenario, probably something between, you know, more in the middle as far as what would happen. And but then you lose credibility. And these kind of things, I think, are really important right now. And I wish people, including myself, would have read this book a year ago going into this pandemic, when we're trying to make sense of how the media is hyping up, it's the end of the world, wear 3 masks and stay in your home, get in a bunker, or whatever else. It's all like the apocalypse, which the reason is because we don't really have ways to control people other than one of people's favorite ways to control people is just by fear.
And it works.
Yeah, it unfortunately works. And hopefully it will work less as we like mature as a species. But unfortunately, it's still working. And maybe we can learn from that a little bit, getting through this pandemic.
Now think what the population of men with low testosterone, who experience anxiety strongly.
Right.
They experience fear strongly.
Mm.
Because they watch porn, they masturbate, they eat soy-containing products. They don't get enough sunlight. They don't get enough animal fats. They don't get enough saturated fats. They don't eat egg yolks. They shower with xenoestrogen-containing cosmetics.
Oh.
They wear artificial clothes from artificial fabrics. All of this reduces testosterone, leads to anxiety, leads to fear, and all of these men are very easy to control with fear by whoever wants to control them. This is what we saw last year.
Mm. Yeah, well, and especially because traditionally, or and partly in our instincts, the males be the leaders of our culture, our family, and all those things. Whereas now, of course, everything's about crush the patriarchy and destroy all that, where, you know, all that's happening is, you know, with the feminist movement, which, you know, of course, sometimes I might say things against how the feminist movement has become too authoritarian. But, you know, both of my grandmothers were part of the American League for Women Voters. And, you know, we need to have women's rights and women's voting and everything else. But it's gotten to this level where it's like destroy capitalism, destroy the patriarchy, even in, you know, the movies and in the culture and everything else. It's like make men weak and make men into horrible leaders and horrible people. And what that does is then, like, maybe in our culture going into World War II or some other time in history, men would stand up and be the leaders and be like, okay, we've got to fight and we've got to overcome this thing and we're going to be the leaders and we're going to handle this situation. But yeah, it's a very turning us into sheep. And I guess maybe sometimes that's what people feel like is the better thing when they're worried about overpopulation and things is herd animals might be better in their minds. But I don't know. What do you think about what that maybe is, what is going on in the culture and what that we can do about it as far as the culture trying to be more weak as it's like a virtue and victimhood being a virtue, kind of like take it to another point. But what do we do when the culture is becoming so weak and how do we maybe handle that and deal with it?
You have to be a living example of the ideal you wish to right. embody.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so you don't have to fight. This is how you fight.
Mm.
By building. Because the people who create that culture, they are chopping the branch on which they stand.
Right.
So for thousands of years, people had to figure out ways to organize their behavior in order to survive the pretty shitty Dark Ages. Not only the Dark Ages, but history in general.
Right.
Was pretty shitty up until recently. It's very difficult to organize a large amount of people in a sustainable way that leads to progress and not to death.
Mm-hmm.
And so, although that culture definitely has many bad aspects, throwing it away without having anything better to offer is suicide, because you're burning down the house which you dislike while still living inside that house, while still depending on that house. This is like being on a deathbed, being terminally ill in a hospital, severely ill in a hospital, and you have all these tubes going in your body, sustaining your life. And you're like, well, these medications and these medical devices are imperfect. Let's burn them all down while you still depend on them. This is what happens. Everybody dies if you continue with that rhetoric.
You know, it makes me think of a lot of the scenes last year with, you know, rioting and burning cities and burning buildings and all of that. And I think a lot of how that happened is we're naturally aggressive creatures, but because we sort of like repressed our aggression for so long, and then the media and even the politicians are all saying, stay in your house unless you're going to protest. And of course, we're social.
Makes sense, yes.
Yeah, we're social creatures. So we're going to go out I didn't do any public protesting, but a lot of people went out and did public protesting and burning things down. So what happens is you like control those sort of instincts. But then it's like so much of this last year was like a huge social experiment. Like, let's see if these people will do this stupid thing. Wow, they did it. People are really stupid. What has been your perspective on that in Europe, by the way? Because I've mostly just been looking at how things were going down in America. But what has that been like being in Europe as far as the way people have been herded around on our instincts and everything else the past year, especially?
Absolutely the same thing.
Yeah.
No difference.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely zero thought.
Mm-hmm.
All obedience.
Yeah.
Zero critical thinking,
right.
Even from the people I know who preach about intelligence and critical thinking and evidence.
Right.
Suddenly, when presented with contrary evidence, their critical thinking and their scientism breaks down.
Right.
I won't say more. Have you watched, have you read The Brave New World from Huxley?
Yeah, a long time ago, but yeah.
I saw that there is TV series created following the topic of the book. It's loosely connected to the book.
Right, based on it.
But it's based on the book, but it catches the atmosphere, the gist, the soul of the book. It catches the soul of the book to a great extent. Because you use the words controlling human instincts quite a few times.
Yeah.
And if you remember, the whole premise of the book was that if you let human instincts loose, things are going to get bad, which isn't true, because free human instincts created the modern world.
Yeah.
Now, in the Brave New World, what happens? You are genetically preselected before you are born to be of a certain intelligence and of a certain temperament, even at a certain level of aggression, so that you perfectly fit your predetermined social role. So, for example, if your social role is to mop the floor, your embryo's brain is being damaged with radiation and chemicals, so that you're stupid and so that you're happy with your stupid job. And everybody was taking this drug Soma each time they feel a strong emotion so that they don't have to worry about strong emotions. It's complete insanity. And you know that the worst thing about the TV series was that in the end, I got the impression that the last episode of the first season portrayed the Brave New World as the desirable social system. They portrayed free people as aggressive, ugly, stupid barbarians. Wow. And in the end, the Brave New World, their social system collapsed because a barbarian infiltrated the system and people changed their behavior and they killed each other. So that's the worst thing. Whoever created that TV series is pushing propaganda for social control. Second thing, have you watched one masterpiece movie called Equilibrium?
I don't think I did. Tell us about it a little bit.
It's a relatively low budget, but it became pretty famous and successful. It has cool side effects, nevertheless. But the story is amazing. World War III ended. Humanity almost killed itself. And the government decides that... in order to prevent the fourth world war from ever occurring, each person should start taking drugs which annihilate their emotion. And everything which can spark an emotion is being hunted down by special forces and destroyed. Art, music, anything cute, and people are like zombies, pretty cold, behaving pretty cold to each other. The plot of the movie is about one hunter, one special unit hunter, whose job is to hunt down people who refuse to take the drugs and burn them alive.
Wow.
He forgot to take his medicine and start experiencing emotions for the first time.
Wow.
So that the plot twist, but in the end, so I spoiled the ending, so whoever wants to watch.
Spoiler alert. There's just a spoiler.
The guy who controls society does not take his drugs.
The man behind the curtain.
In the Brave New World, the world controller, Mont. He, in the book, is he is not part of the system.
Yeah, I mean, it almost reminds me of, like, how...
Who controls the controllers?
That's deep, because it's... I mean, humanity is all one organism. The only thing is that we go through...
No, it isn't. No, it isn't.
Well, it is and it isn't. It isn't in that we all need to behave as... autonomous, independent individuals, but it is in that we're all connected and we are all part of the same social world and psychological world and reality and existence and planet. But it's always that way, that we absolutely need to have our autonomous individuality, and we need to also respect and deal with the reality of being at a place within the totality of the whole group, not just in the present day and like what things are like in 2021, whatever, but what things are like throughout history and our place moving along that timeline. So it's connected. It's the same thing, but at the same time, it's not, you know, almost like a everything in the environment. They are, you know, like the bees are the flowers and the flowers are the bees. You don't have one without the other. And everything else in the environment. I mean, there might be some things that could go extinct and the world could go on without them. And we should try to avoid things going extinct, but they're still connected and we are responsible for them. But tell me why that they're not, or what you think about that.
I would rather not elaborate.
Okay. But what you were saying a minute ago before that is on this issue of, it almost seems like the popular notion, especially since this literature has come out in the last 100 years or so, about just overcoming emotion and repressing or suppressing emotion. And this is, I'm sure, something that you studied or read about a bit in your neurological studies. It just makes me think of that brief fad for a couple decades of people who were suffering from mental illness. They would lobotomize, and maybe you can talk more about that, but that's where, you know, they would scrape out their frontal lobes a bit, and that would make the person not feel. So then, because they couldn't have feelings essentially, then they wouldn't be so neurotic, but they also would lose their capacity to do a lot of other things. And that's also something Oliver Sacks talks a lot about in his books that we've both read. But what's been your take on that, and that we need to have emotions and we need to connect to the world in a feeling way, but we get confused on that. So what's your take on that?
I liked how you said you scrape out their prefrontal cortex a little bit.
Well, I kind of said it that way because I wasn't trying to go into too much deep details. Maybe you can, being the more neuroscientist that you are, because people don't talk about lobotomies as much as they used to, but I think it's actually important that people understand that concept, because sometimes we get in this whole like feelings are the devil kind of thing, or we need to just like think and overcome our emotions with our thoughts. But I don't know, maybe you can tell us more about what a lobotomy is like and why we should not get those.
So lobotomy is a pretty cool thing. So you get a very long needle and a hammer, and you put the needle inside someone's nose through the nasal cavity. Mm-hmm. And with the hammer, I was thinking about something else. It was done, if I'm correct, it was done actually through slightly above the eye.
Yeah, I think there was two different ones. One procedure went through the nose somehow, and one went through the like corner of the eye somehow.
The lobotomy is a highly advanced method of. It's very cool. I think we should bring back. We should bring back mandatory lobotomies for people we dislike.
Oh yeah, for if we dislike them, only the people we dislike.
We should label them too emotional, for example. And I think that mandatory lobotomy should be in order to save lives and to protect others. Lobotomy should be mandatory. Trust the experts. Science says that lobotomies work. And that was true less than a century ago. It was true very recently. I mean, less than one human lifetime ago, literally. Thousands, tens of thousands of people were labeled as people who were enemies to someone, people who were not, who were political, who were politically in, I can't find the correct word, whatever. People with power did not like. They were labeled mentally ill, and they were administered a highly advanced new procedure. I think there is a Nobel Prize for lobotomies. The guy got a Nobel Prize.
Yeah, back in the 50s or 60s.
I do not believe in the Nobel Prize. If you can give a Nobel Prize for such thing, that's complete insanity. It doesn't take a lot of thinking to see that this is wrong.
Yeah, well, and... again,
now the question is
go ahead.
So in a sense, treating a person with a lobotomy is like treating treating a pimple by chopping off your head.
Yeah.
Yeah. You don't have a pimple, or no, it's treating myopia or astigmatism by taking out the eye.
Mm.
This is what lobotomy is. Now, here is a question for you. Don't answer.
Okay.
Answer. That's a question for everybody who is listening.
Sure.
Today, right now, this moment, this minute, what is our modern world's lobotomy, which would be considered insanely inhumane, unethical, and evil 50 years down the road? Don't answer that, but think about it for a moment.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I think we can't answer it or we'd get canceled.
Mm-hmm.
Or
you know the rules of the game. All right.
Yeah. Hmm. Well, let me see if I can halfway answer something like that without doing so, but that...
Don't do it.
Well, just less than halfway then, I guess. But it's just that if we administer unproven science to the population, and in other words, untested science or science that we're administering to the population without testing it on groups of people for years, then it's the same thing as the lobotomy experiment. Because the lobotomy experiment was assumed, like, okay, we do procedure A. This procedure is to solve one problem. The problem is people are neurotic or whatever, and it solves that problem. But then it takes maybe a year or a few years before they realize what's really changed, that our feelings are so necessary to make all of our decisions in life. So these people who got lobotomized are just like seem normal, but are completely dysfunctional as far as being like a normal member of society.
They were zombies. They just stared at the wall and they were drooling. That it.
Yeah, but it solved the problem of them being unhappy.
Yeah, if they had high subjective
well-being.
If I put you into a coma, you won't be unhappy anymore. If I chop off your leg, you won't you can't stop your toe anymore.
True.
Hey, do you want me to get technical? Because I can.
Give That's you why you're here with your white coat on.
The white coat is actually. I don't want to look as an authority. I do it exactly the opposite. I hate authority.
Okay.
Since I was a child, I hate authority. I don't take authority. I do take what I do seriously, but I don't take myself seriously. And I like people like that. You know how much I hate people who really take themselves seriously, who wear the white coat, feel as if they're gods among men, as if that's insanity. I respect people who know that their work is serious, but they do not take themselves seriously. Those are two completely different things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, be with people who seek the truth, but run away from people who found it, something like that. Now, let me get technical about...
Come on, white coat, get technical.
Because it's the other way around. It's actually emotions drive our thoughts more. So there is a bidirectional work. That's the cognitive behavioral theory, that thoughts can influence emotions. So by changing your thoughts, you can change your emotions. And this is how in cognitive behavioral therapy, when you address these cognitive distortions like catastrophizing, overgeneralization, stuff like that, you can feel less anxious, less depressed because you change your thoughts. But that takes effort. That takes conscious effort. What actually happens every day automatically is that our emotions determine the state of our thoughts. Now let's discuss anatomically how this happens. So so look at my head. So imagine that my head is a brain. So right in the middle of the brain, there are two ovoid structures. Ovoid means they look like eggs.
Sure.
We call them the thalami, the thalamus.
Mm.
Maybe you've heard of the thalamus.
Mm.
So the thalami are a relay station between the lower parts of the brain and the cortex. So
yeah, like the lizard brain.
Something like that. Not sure. Does the lizard have thalamus? Probably, yes. Yes, so the thalamus might receive all sensory information, for example, and then they can, you can still feel pain only with your thalamus, for example, but that would, you would only say, well, I feel pain. You can't say how much, where. So the thalamus is like a small beta version of your cortex. Mm-hmm. And that's an overgeneralization. And the thalamus is like a mirror image of the cortex.
Mm-hmm.
Because each part of the thalamus projects to a certain area of the cortex. Now, I will tell you why this is important.
Mm-hmm.
There is one big group of nuclei in the thalamus. We call them the medial dorsal nuclei, also known as the medial nuclei. Medial dorsal or medial is the same thing in terms of the thalamus, the medial dorsal nuclei. They receive information from many parts of the brain, including the parts of the limbic system, including the hypothalamus. So they can really sense what emotions you're currently experiencing. Because when you're experiencing emotion, your heart rate increases. Your blood sugar increases, preparing you to fight, for example. Your breathing becomes more, you breathe faster.
Right.
And all that information is related to that medial dorsal nucleus.
Mm-hmm.
And the magic happens. The
all
medial dorsal nucleus sends that information to the prefrontal cortex, which we discussed just now.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens is that the medial dorsal nucleus tells the prefrontal cortex to figure out a story which will explain why your body is feeling this way right now. Now, let me give you an everyday example which you can relate to what happens.
Okay.
You wake up, and you waked up not long ago today, and you feel not very energetic. Let's say that you woke up early today. You don't have energy. You didn't have a lot of sleep. Your body feels terrible. Your hormones are dysregulated. You don't have
this energy. Is iced coffee, by the way, but go ahead.
All right. So you feel bad. And you're a professor, and today is an exam. You have to examine students. There is an oral exam. You feel bad because your biochemistry and hormones are totally messed up because you had to wake up early. This is what the medial dorsal nucleus receives. And it sends to the prefrontal cortex that information. The prefrontal cortex will search in your environment for clues why you feel that way. And in front of the professor sits a student. And the student tries to show their knowledge, but they aren't, most of the time, they aren't successful at doing that. And the professor will suddenly start thinking that the reason for his bad emotions, for his bad state, is the student themselves. And the professor will say, well, the professor will start getting angry at the student. Then the professor will eat a chocolate for breakfast. That's the worst thing which you can eat for breakfast. You are fat. Your insulin sensitivity is high, and your blood sugar initially will spike pretty high in the morning. And
you want protein and natural fat for breakfast,
of
right?
Of course, but when you eat chocolate on an empty stomach in the morning, especially if you had bad sleep, that will increase your blood. That will increase your insulin a lot in the beginning. Insulin will enter your brain. And insulin will lead to brain fog. You won't be able to concentrate. But that information, the medial dorsal nucleus sends to the prefrontal cortex, and the prefrontal cortex is like, speak more clearly. I can't understand the word you're saying. And 1 hour later, because you had fast carbohydrates, your blood sugar will plummet. It will drop. Suddenly you have low blood sugar.
You get over the spike.
Yes, and you'll get angry because you need to activate stress hormones to get out some blood sugar from your sugar deposits in the body.
Right.
But due to the connection through the medial dorsal nucleus and the prefrontal cortex, the professor suddenly will be like, your answers are making me angry. Do you know that the majority, almost all domestic violence occurs when one of the partners is hungry?
Yeah. Because hungry or drunk?
Yeah, they will conflate the internal state with something happening in the environment. Nothing right. changes. The spouse is the same. They don't change over time. But suddenly you will start interpreting their behavior in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
So that's actually not only are emotions useful for making decisions, emotions usually make the decisions before we realize that. Then the thoughts work in reverse to rationalize what we felt, not the other way around.
Good. I'm glad you're here with the white coat to give us that technical stuff. but let me, because I've been trying to make sense of this, like, it makes more sense as an instinct brain and a thinking brain than a feeling versus a and a thinking brain, which is kind of like what we're getting at there. But I think it's even maybe a little more to it than that, is that our unconscious mind, our right brain, is all about metaphor and symbol and story. And although we have trouble putting that into words, and that's why we see a story or a metaphor or something that fulfills that symbol or that image that we had in our unconscious mind, and then it links to the conscious mind, and then that puts it in words. And so when there's that, those links between something coming from the unconscious to the conscious mind, then it comes through as emotion or feelings, and maybe instinct was the vehicle, but it's that in our unconscious mind, we're forming an identity that has to do with our place in the whole psychological environment or our whole world that we built for us. And we need that world to make sense so that we are making or that we are in a coherent position in the world that we're in. You know, just like sort of an evolutionary theory, sometimes we would be more aquatic and sometimes we would be more in trees and sometimes we'd be more, you know, we were very adaptive in our environment. Same thing in our mental environment. Sometimes we realize, okay, this person is not my friend anymore. They are the enemy. Or this person is my friend. I need to become closer to this person, or this organization is the Nazis, or this organization is the saviors, you know. And so then those come through as feelings, but what they are is they are value structures or structures of meaning that are in our unconscious mind and that we are fulfilling. What's your take on that, on like the deeper level of what's in the unconscious beyond just the as it comes across as instinct and feeling?
I can't discuss the non-conscious in a way which can give anything valuable today, but I can say, I can share something about not the unconscious, but the non-verbal.
Sure, yeah.
The non-rational mind. It's something which Jordan Peterson has said many times. You cannot argue with the meaning of music.
Right.
A sad song is sad and you cannot explain why.
Right.
For example, you cannot rationally and logically make it less sad. Although we can discuss why music, I support the notion of the concept of the idea of Steven Pinker that music is a cheesecake for the brain. Do you want me to elaborate a bit, because I can share a very interesting study on that?
Sure.
So I had the same thought independent of Pinker, which is cool. When I saw that someone else has reached the same conclusion. Actually, we use our ears a lot. Our auditory information is extremely important.
Right.
And big animals have a big rib cage, large chest, and they produce lower sounds, like, you know, they're lower sounds. And smaller animals produce a higher pitched sound. This is why animals growl at each other
to make them seem bigger than they are.
actually to determine who has the bigger chest.
Mm.
And the animal who has the larger, the bigger chest is more likely to win because they have more pectoral muscles there.
Hmm.
So they don't have to fight and risk killing each other or injuring each other.
They just have a growling contest first.
Yeah, the growling will determine with high probability who the winner is. So they don't have to fight afterwards. All animals do that.
Interesting. Uh-huh.
Yeah, because even if you win, you'll be injured and then another one will come and easily take you out.
Hmm. Yeah,
so
yeah.
Nobody wins. So we in certain sounds in nature are lower pitched, like earthquakes, like tsunamis, like storms. They produce specific lower pitched sounds.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that music. So these sounds elicit emotions.
Mm-hmm.
Something even more interesting. Mm-hmm. All mothers in all languages, in all cultures, they call their children with the musical interval minor third, which is mommy. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure whether I sung that right. You know, it's mommy, something like that. Mommy. Now the interesting thing, so we have our brain pays attention to the minor third, and the ambulance sound is in a minor third. The same like mommy, because we evolved to listen to that sound. Now, about the auditory cheesecake, I thought that music acts something like a super stimulus because it combines a lot of sounds which elicit emotions. When you want to make the music epic, you use lower pitch sounds, drums, things which will resemble a storm.
Mm-hmm.
But music creates these sounds in such a refined way that it acts actually as a super stimulus, literally. Now, what experiments were done in that regard? Why do animals do not respond to music? Because human music should reflect sounds which make sense to humans, you know, in evolutionary terms. So people calculated the people listen to the sounds which tambourine monkeys produce. They also calculated the speed at which they communicate with each other. They talk faster, and they composed music which, in their opinion, should make sense to them.
They made chimp music?
Tamarind music, yes. So it doesn't sound like music to us. It has no meaning. It's like random sounds for us. But for them, they actually had a hypothesis. This piece should make them angry. This piece, musical piece, should make them sad. And indeed, their behavior changed in line with the hypothesis of the researchers.
Interesting.
Because they figured out which sounds make them angry, and they created music around that.
Interesting. I mean, the thing with music is that it's like a archetype of order almost, because what happens is our minds start to put together the puzzles, because it's not just about it's not a constant sound. It's the it's what happens between the sound. It's almost like a dance isn't about doing these like 10 moves the quickest, and a song isn't about like getting from the beginning to the end the fastest. It's about doing it in a way that will connect the artist to the listener, or you know the art piece, which is you know the sounds to the listener. And it works because our minds put together these patterns, and I guess they work on humans because of our innate instincts of whatever. Yeah, I've never heard about that study before, that animals have different sound instincts. I mean, it makes sense. And I mean, we've been
as a scientist recorded the chirping of crickets. However, they slowed it down. So they calculated how much longer humans live compared to crickets.
Okay.
And so I don't know how long crickets live, but they slowed it down that many times. Because for us, it sounds like chirping, but for them it should sound much slower because their brain works faster. The smaller the brain, the faster it works. So flies, for example, see us in slow motion. Their brain works much faster. Their psychological time runs faster. And when you slow down the cricket sounds to human speeds, it sounds like angels singing. It's amazing. Yeah, it's one of the most beautiful things which I've ever heard. You can search that on YouTube.
All right.
Imagine how that sounds to them.
I guess that makes them happy. Now I feel bad for killing crickets. There's been a couple times when it's like a cricket got in the house or whatever, and I had to hunt it down because it wasn't letting me sleep with its angel sounds. Now I feel bad for killing the melodic angels of the night.
Although bugs aren't stupid at all. I watch a lot of nature documentaries, and I saw extremely complex behavior from bugs, from individual bugs. Not emergent behaviors from social animal insects like ants, but individual bugs can do quite complex things.
Right.
Especially cockroaches are extremely intelligent, and they will when they hear you, they will stop. They will slowly try to see whether you're there. You know, they will try to be sneaky. That isn't a stupid. So I mean that even if an animal is stupid, though, that doesn't mean that it cannot experience pain and suffering. We should think that pain and suffering are evolutionarily pretty old, because it gives you the most important information whether your body is sustaining damage at the moment. So I don't think that the argument that the more intelligent the animal is, the more moral concern we should have towards it makes sense, because what we actually want to do is to decrease suffering. A human baby is more stupid than an adult cockroach, for example. And I'm very careful with the words I choose. I don't want to use anti-natalist, anti-human language, not at all. I don't want to use the language of vegans, which hate humans and put other species above us. Not at all. But I want to make the argument that a human newborn has a less complex behavior, is less capable of problem solving compared to an adult cockroach, and yet you won't perform surgery on a human newborn without anesthesia. You see, it isn't important how intelligent an animal is, but whether it has the capacity to experience suffering. And so there was a recent study, an experimental study on flies, showing that probably flies can experience chronic pain because of the behavior they elicit after a trauma, and inside their nervous system, the immune system changes in a way, the immune system of the nervous system, which is actually my subspecialty within the neurosciences, that immune system changes in ways which are pretty similar to what happens with people with chronic pain inside their spinal cords. So that totally makes sense.
Are you trying to make me feel bad for killing crickets with their melodic angel music and their suffering that I put them through?
Well, no, I've killed insects too. We should be pragmatic about it. So maybe the extreme behavior is Jainism, where people walk with like a mop or something in front of them, and they
always have a mask on.
Yeah, they wipe the floor not to step on a bug. They do not eat food they don't eat fermented food because it contains a lot of living organisms in that. So it makes sense on a certain level, of course.
Yeah.
But we should accept that living involves inflicting some basic level of suffering on other beings. We should aim at reducing that suffering pragmatically,
right,
without increasing our own suffering in the process.
Right.
And you know, we should accept that. We should aim to reduce that, but within pragmatic limits, without getting extreme and ideological.
Well, okay. There is this issue of what suffering is, because humans have another type of suffering that other creatures don't. We have like existential suffering that can lead to nihilism and such things. And I think the reason is, and this kind of ties together, I think maybe, or it can, a few of these topics that we've been on, is that when we're disconnected from our meaning or we don't believe that we're doing things that are meaningful, or we don't find passionate and meaning in what we do, we either divert to somehow doing that by, you know, getting involved in political movements or ideological movements or whatever that fulfill that need, or we fall into this nihilism, which is a pain, and that pain is supposed to help you. It's a signal from your psychology, your mind saying, give me meaning, and then you can, and to sort of like this whole thing of our ability to have feelings or not, or overcome our feelings, is really what we need to do is get in a meaning structure and a value structure, or get ourselves in a in the position of doing what we ought to do for our unique sort of purpose, or at least on that transcendent sort of path, or on that higher path, or aiming up. And then we start to find meaning and become authentically rewarded in our like deep psychological ways, rather than artificially so, like through these ideological political things or whatever, and overcome our nihilism. So I guess the point or thing that I'm getting at or asking is like, do we overcome our issues, or do we get in a better position when we start living a meaningful life, and then do so, we can then probably do so passionately or with our feelings?
You see how easy it is to become attracted to an extreme political party or to a cult, because they give you structure, meaning, they give you they tell you what is right, what is wrong, who the good guys are, who the bad guys are, right. You know what you need to do. Suddenly the world makes sense, it becomes much more simpler, there is a reward, and you can feel as if you're a hero.
Mm-hmm.
There is an easier and much more wholesome way to do that, and that is to have children. If you have children, suddenly the next immediate goal reveals itself in front of you. You have to change the diaper, for example. And if you don't do that, the consequences will be great, because another human being depends on you.
Mm-hmm.
So that's meaningful, and it always has been. Also, you can see the child grow. That's your genetic investment. That's your genetic immortality. And that if you take care of the child will love you. The child will show you all of his love. So children, small children, are unless you spoil them, they're angels, and they can show you. They can show you sincere love, much more sincere than the love of a dog, for example, because the dog loves you unconditionally, but the children, for them, you're a hero, you are a great authority. I don't have children yet, although I want to a lot. I can't produce them myself, you know.
In a lab.
I can try, actually. That should be the next project.
And
instant child, just add water. And
a little Marin clone.
Yeah.
Iron Brain Jr.
Yeah, something like that. I went to this village deep in the mountains, and there were several children there. They were playing, and they got interested in what I was doing. We started talking. I started telling them interesting stories, and they came every day, and they all of them cried when I left, because the amount of sincere love and affection which a child can give you is... I felt something inside which I didn't know that I was capable of. That was a game changer. I never knew that such feelings were possible. And it was an almost religious experience.
Right.
Because the meaning is revealed in front of you. And armchair intellectual discussions about nihilism. It sounds absurd after you felt that instinct. So I think that one neglected way to really find meaning is to have children and love them. Don't spoil them. But if you love your children, you won't spoil them. You'll help them grow to become complete human beings who would be equipped with values and behaviors to reduce suffering in the world. It's more meaningful than that.
I agree with you, but we're in that same boat where we are young-ish guys that don't have children and maybe probably will at some point in the coming years. We'll see at whenever that happens, however that happens, whether we clone ourselves or whatever. The other thing that really brings to mind, okay, like myself, I have a bunch of nieces and nephews that I tried to have those experiences with, like you mentioned, which is kind of like halfway there, but definitely not quite. But I think this gets to a deeper idea, which is that the real joy is, yes, absolutely, in being a parent, being an uncle, being mentor, perhaps to a young person. Also along those same lines is handing down knowledge, not just to peers or not just to their academics to boost our egos, but hand it down to the next generation so that the next generation can really be better and really multiply in a better culture and a better place. And so I think that's a lot of what we try to do, even if we joke about it or have these conversations about nihilism and woke people and whatever else. It's making the next generation probably a little bit better than this generation. But what do you think?
Yeah, of course, I should put the disclaimer that since I don't have children yet, everything which I said may be wrong. It's just an instinct which I had. Of course, don't take it... Don't take it as advice, but of course, I don't want to say foolish things. It's something which I think. So it's not medical or relationship advice. It's it's my own hypothesis. I teach quite a lot. I've been teaching for 7 years now in medical school. I work with young, intelligent people. And sometimes I have older students. Once actually in my first year, I had a student who was 60 years old, and he had 3 medical specialties.
Wow.
However, he had to flee his country because he had enough of the bullshit which was going on there.
Okay.
And he was highly educated, obviously, but he had a hard time finding a job in the place where he moved to. He got threatened with a gun by a patient several times. So that's apparently a thing which happens there. And he said, well, but I'm leaving.
In his other country.
In his office, yes. He then came to our university to study dental medicine. He said, well, I have 3 medical specialties, but I can't find a job, so I'll become a dentist at an older age. It seems that person had huge respect, showed extreme respect, actually, surprisingly extreme respect to me. And I was 25 at the time. That was 7 years ago. I was 25. That came as a surprise to me, because you have someone who is much more experienced, and yet we had such a relationship. And why did that occur? I derive extreme meaning out of teaching. Although you can't imagine, I like doing it. I try to be as good as I can be there. Although that isn't rewarded at all in academia. Academia rewards you for doing other things, which in teaching is like a burden.
Yeah. It's mainly about peer reviews, publishing, and all those kind of things.
Which is a good thing, yes. It's a good thing on its own. But teaching, if you're a good teacher, that nobody cares.
Right.
You know, there is no punishment for being a bad teacher, but...
No reward for being a good teacher in academia.
Not only I enjoy it, I discovered that since I was a child, I wanted to explain things to people. Since I could, even from kindergarten, I was reading science books for children. I wanted to explain things to people, to discuss these things. And some people told me, I remember that as people who saw me once or twice as a child, and they said, I remembered you as the little boy who likes to explain. So that's a thing. Apparently, this is some genetic thing, you know, that proclivity to explain things, to derive pleasure from it.
Right.
So that's my thing. So I discovered my thing. And if I can, no, I won't say that. But okay, I can explain things, and I like doing that. And it seems that people...
It's part of your purpose.
So it's part of my nature, you know. Yeah. And it seems that students can appreciate that. If they want to learn, students who just want to pass the exam with the minimum amount of efforts hate me.
Yeah.
That's a natural. They don't want to know. They want, you know, why are you explaining this? You know, we aren't here to learn. We are here to pass.
Right.
But I see that teaching in general has lost its status because there is this joke: who can do does. Who cannot do teaches, and who do that, the guy who can't teach teaches gym. And so I see that I had maybe one or two, one. I had one good teacher in high school. And in medical school, I had maybe two or three people who I could call true teachers and mentors.
Right.
The rest were some people who talked about some information. How can you command, how can you have respect? That's not teaching, that's an oxymoron.
Yeah, teaching is a true calling that a lot of people are given that position, but they unfortunately don't really want it, or that it's just not their calling.
They suck.
I guess.
So you take someone who has, you take an economist or some entrepreneur who never built a business to teach children entrepreneurialism in school.
Yeah.
Entrepreneurship in school. It's insane.
Yeah.
Oh, and almost all teachers are women, aging women.
Yeah. Middle-aged women.
Aging women, you know, which isn't a bad thing, but that has specific psychological traits associated with that. And you have young boys who are forced to sit still inside a dusty room under fluorescent light. And they have no role model whose behavior they can copy.
That's insane.
That's a recipe for disaster.
And another thing I heard from the girls who I've had on a couple times that are teachers, I think they're high school teachers or they work in high schools, but they have a channel for MBTI personality. And what they say is most teachers are, for whatever reason, on like that Myers-Briggs, Carl Jung's sensing versus intuiting and thinking versus feeling, but most of them are predominantly the sensing type, where most students, especially nowadays, are predominantly the intuiting type, at least in that pair. And so the sensing type often thinks the intuiting type is just dumb or like off in some dreamland when they're just processing information differently.
The sensing types are zombies and robots.
Yeah, and they like that. they think that's the virtue.
To be a robot. Now let me tell you what teaching is. Teaching isn't teaching nowadays is some aging lady telling children facts about where you can find coal in or oil in some geographical area. That's not what teaching is. Teaching is sculpting of brains, because children...
minds. We're not giving lobotomies. We should say minds, probably.
brains directly, sculpting, literally.
All right, because just as long as we're not putting any ice picks inside people's heads.
right now, my words travel vast distances, and through that device, my words are leading to physical mechanical vibrations of your eardrums.
Okay, all right.
Leads to electrical impulses in your brain.
Especially nowadays that we know more about neuroplasticity and those kind of things. So,
yeah, so the words literally change the physical structure of the brain.
You're right. We're sculpting our brains, but okay, go ahead.
We're sculpting our brain. No lobotomy is required.
Yeah.
Although I think that we should bring back dungeons in universities for students who misbehave or take themselves too seriously. Dungeons can be a nice place to discipline.
Maybe for some of the teachers too.
Oh, definitely, yes. But, you know, I was joking about that with someone involved in teaching as well. And she was a youngish, attractive woman. But it seems that she had a specific fetish for dungeons, and I didn't.
What?
That didn't went well.
50 Shades of Grey person.
on steroids. You know,
wow.
I can discuss why this fetish develops out of the neuroanatomy, but that would derail the discussion.
All right, maybe next time.
Maybe next time about I can speak about the neuroscience of sexual fetishes, why they develop. That's very interesting. But some other time.
Yeah, we'll do the sex education maybe on our next podcast.
So, yeah, we need that actually. Yeah. Because people are having less sex nowadays.
That's true.
We have more sex. That's a command. That's an order for everyone listening. Go and have more.
Be
sex.
Fruitful and multiply.
Yeah, exactly. Responsible sex with a respecting partner, of course.
Yes.
Yeah, not the soulless one with people with NPCs. Whatever. No,
anyway,
I want to say something else. The teaching is not conveying information. Teaching is the sculpting of brains. Children will spend more time with their teachers throughout their waking hours than with their parents.
True, yeah.
So actually the teachers are responsible for nurturing. They are responsible for the optimal development of the brain, of the temperament, of the skills, of the values of the next generation.
Right.
You see how dangerous it is to put mediocre people who never succeeded, who may be filled with self-doubt, low self-esteem, who may suffer hormonal shifts of their behavior, who may be neurotic, who do not look heroic. That's a bad role model to place in front of your children, because they will become the same. We need heroes to teach our children. Not to teach, just to exist in the classroom. And the children should look at that ideal. And they will biologically strive to become the same. Think about that.
Well, yeah. And you're right. And I think about this a lot. I've talked about it a couple times on the podcast, and that the universities or the education system in general, we can have all these ideals like you're talking about, that we need heroic teachers and those type of things. But
where are the heroes?
Well, it's that's not happening, or at least that's not the trend anytime soon. I mean, there may be some good teachers. It sounds like you're one. We can probably think of a few. But since there are not many, I'm wondering if the answer might be in learning to become those who go out and find such things, whether that's through the plethora of information on YouTube and other videos available online, or just even now that we have unlimited, almost, books and audiobooks, so that we can connect with good teachers, even if it's just over video and audio, and so that we can connect with really good books that we wouldn't have been given through the school system. Is that maybe part of the answer, is for maybe any young people that might listen? I mean, I'm sure there's at least a few. We can't just sit around hoping that we get better teachers. We've got to make do with what we have. And a lot of that is to make the most of this world where we have like unlimited knowledge and information at our fingertips.
Of course, yes, that's a possible solution. If we don't have heroic teachers, then children will naturally seek the next best thing, so they will be drawn to superheroes.
Right.
And superheroes aren't quite virtuous most of the time, because the Hollywood media, they push a specific type of agenda.
Right.
The superheroes will push a specific type of agenda, which isn't consistent with surviving of the human life in the long term. But I won't say more.
Well, the way you put that, it puts it in a dilemma as people who want to become more educated at whatever stage in life, or the dilemma is whether we are a young person trying to make the best of our life, or maybe we're just like the guy that you mentioned that was your student, 50 something years old with 3 medical specialties, but he wants to learn. Is that we can make the most of it by not just getting sucked into the propaganda through heroes and Hollywood movies that are mostly made off of Chinese communist money, not going too much down that Hollywood made in China conspiracy, but
Freudian slip.
Yeah, something like that. But getting our values through finding, meaningful literature and meaningful teachers, like I said, especially since now we can learn that the made in China media isn't going to always give us the best values. But if we find the better teachers, the better information, and the classical literature, like you even mentioned, A Brave New World, 1984 is a similar one, where they show us in this sort of classical canonical way that this is the way society can go. And it's like a lot of what we're seeing now in our strange modern world, especially this past year. What do we do about this world without much heroes? Can we find our own, even just through literature? Hopefully some good ones through the classics and not through China.
I will discuss the literature, but first let's define a hero. A hero sacrifices himself for others.
Because
people in the Hollywood heroes are people with exceptional abilities,
right?
Which they show off. They can't lose. They have exceptional abilities. They show them off, and the Hollywood hero is a narcissistic ego-feeding entity.
Right.
In order to be a hero, you don't have to have super abilities.
Mm-hmm.
You may be a blind, disabled person. But to be a hero means to sacrifice yourself when you're faced with a moral dilemma.
Mm-hmm.
So that you help others. That's a hero. And if you aren't a hero each time when you're presented with such a challenge, the world gets a bit worse.
Right.
And when billions of people do that every day, then we die by, it would be a death by a billion cuts. The small acts, the small deeds of heroism every day is what keeps darkness at bay. Small acts of kindness, small acts of self-sacrifice, this is what keeps the darkness at bay. Because if we reach the point where a single hero, large superhero, should emerge to save us all, then that means that we've reached the tipping point. And even if the hero saves us, the damage which would be done would be enormous. Like in the superhero movies, actually. By the time we need the superhero, the whole city is destroyed to rubble, to dust. You understand what I mean? Mm-hmm. So the small everyday acts of heroism are even more important than the large ones. Exercising every day is much better than one large surgery at the end, if you right. know what I mean. Regarding literature, I would advise to read mm-hmm. things which are old.
Yeah, the canonical works.
And read the Greeks,
mm-hmm.
where true heroes mm-hmm. lived, where heroism was part of the culture, people, mm-hmm. part of the destiny, but people strived to be heroes. So read the ancient Greeks. That's very important if you want to have a knack of what heroism means. Now, I read a lot of fiction. Mm-hmm. Now I'm finishing the Rift War saga. It's a fantasy, but I think it's 20, it's 30 books, something like that.
Wow.
I'm finishing that. You can read them very, very quickly. They aren't, they are easy to read.
Okay.
And within these books,
mm-hmm.
you find characters who have valor,
mm-hmm.
who sacrifice themselves for the land.
Mm-hmm.
You have true friends who always stay together and they can defeat dark gods and demons and stuff mm-hmm. like that. And I see that I have a really hard time nowadays finding such people who value things like valor, like truth, like friendship, like brotherhood, like self-sacrifice. And you feel a specific type of loneliness, even that you have friends. Even the deepest friendships are somewhat superficial. Where you don't experience that that willingness to die together, to be really invested. That's not a friendship. To be really invested and to have a large mission which you together would be able to accomplish. It's insane. People on the streets, if you bump into them, they are ready to explode. People who are in your own land, people who carry your own genes because you're genetically related. And instead of acting like brothers to love each other and help each other in order to collectively help each other to improve mm. the country,
mm.
people expend extreme amounts of energy into fighting with each other. I see this everywhere. People see that at work, gossip,
right.
backstabbing. People are mocking each other. You mm-hmm. cannot find that feeling of brotherhood, of valor, of that type of love. You see in your lonely if you have these values. You're pretty lonely. There is no one out there whom you can connect. Why okay. is this the case? Why is this the case? Because we have grocery mm. stores. When we have grocery stores who provide cheap food,
yeah.
When we have an air conditioner,
yeah.
which helps with cheap shelter,
mm-hmm.
we don't need each other.
Right.
However, we don't need each other in the short term. But in the long term, if we don't evoke those feelings of brotherhood, valor, heroism, self-sacrifice, we all die, because that food will run out eventually.
True. Let me read a short thing from the end of this book I just got, which is discussing individuation and sort of like the Jungian sense or maturation or something like enlightenment. And it talks about Job, the biblical character who was, at least in the myth, you might say, or the story, was tortured by the devil. And it's a very hard story to understand because it has to do with absolute suffering and how that good can come out of that compared to now, where we have no idea what suffering is other than from a historical perspective here in our sort of advanced world. And it says, a vision such as that of Job certainly points to a different direction, for the outcome of the struggle between God and Satan for the rulership of the world was shown to depend on one man, that if only one man, Job, could stand firm under the most terrible tortures in his allegiance to God, that is, to the good, then Satan's claim to be the prince of this world would be disproven. So the reason I mention that is because as bad as the world might get, as bad as this death by a billion cuts or a trillion cuts or this seeming disintegration of culture or this world where there's barely any leadership or authority or barely any structure, every individual has the ability to stand in the face of that, stand in the face of the disintegrating world and become more instead of less and ascend rather than the easy thing to just go down and descend. And then that is what makes the world constantly better, even on a deeper level, even on like a meta level or a psychological level and not just a physical level, that anyone can be a hero and start to overcome.
Not anyone.
So who can't?
Almost everybody can't. Almost everybody will watch the devil torture you. They will start laughing. They will start mocking. They will start recording that with the smartphone, and they will start commenting, haha, look at that guy, how he's screaming, he deserves that. Many of those will come and help the devil torture you even further.
True, or even torture themselves, but within even all of those individuals, maybe not at that moment, but at some point in their life, they can choose to, in the face of the worst temptation or the worst brainwashing or the worst situations in the world or the worst, like being herded around like sheep out of fear, they can choose to look within themselves and overcome all of that.
That almost never happens, and history shows that.
It's rare, but everyone always has that opportunity. They just usually reject the opportunity.
It is so rare that it doesn't matter, in my opinion, change the course of history.
This, I think, is exactly what keeps us like on this sort of like thin ice that we skate upon, you know, where we might say that it seems like the world's falling apart, or it seems like the world's getting worse, even if it's true in regards to mentally or whatever the case, because in some regards it is. But the reason it doesn't go into total disarray and even like Cold Wars, World Wars, psychological wars and everything else don't destroy everyone, even on a mental level, is because there's always at least someone or at least a handful of people that stand in the face of temptation and torture and anything else. And even if it's only a handful of people or a handful of, or like 1% of 1%, then the world is maintained rather than gets destroyed, because it could get destroyed, but we've made it this far and we'll probably make it a lot farther, because even if it's just a rare handful, enough people stand in the face of temptation and torture and choose to do the higher path rather than the lower path.
That makes sense, yes. However, in order for these extremely rare people to change the course of history, they need to have power. And now they are canceled. If Jesus comes, or if the Buddha comes, they will get canceled. Probably they will be thrown in an insane asylum.
They will be
kicked off YouTube. They would be, their books would be delisted from Amazon.
And, you know, and that may even be a extreme example, you know, it's a true one, probably. But, and I think it's even beyond that, like even the more modern, palatable, relatable figures, like even, it's strange to think of, like, even spirit of someone like Gandhi, or even Martin Luther King Jr., or even Socrates, or Nelson Mandela. What that they did, that sort of power was taken to look what these people did, and now it's like used like a, the ghost of it is like used as like a puppet to manipulate people now. But if those people were around now, then yes, they would be canceled or relegated to prison or whatever else. But the hope I see, and maybe this is me being in my like 20% optimistic gene or whatever the case, but the hope is that those people were in, you know, if you look at Nelson Mandela, went to jail, even, you know, Martin Luther King Jr. spent several stints in jail by everybody, even those who like would support him afterwards, didn't support him at the time. Of course, we know why that Socrates died. You know, it was under political persecution. But because they stood, we have the hope that we have. You know, if they would have crumbled, where they could have crumbled, especially under that immense pressure, the kind of heroes that we think, not just the ones from thousands of years ago, but even modern ones like Gandhi, they could have crumbled under the political pressure and social pressure that they were under. And then that sort of like hero spirit would have died, but they didn't. You know, just like today, of course, if there was a Gandhi around, that person would be canceled, or Martin Luther King Jr., or, you know, these others, they would be canceled because they go against the sheepfold, the mainstream movements. But because they didn't, and whoever the heroes are now on whatever level, because they don't crumble, there's still hope and there's still meaning and there's still the world unconsciously and slowly maintaining that ascent upwards that's in like an invisible, hard to see way. But maybe I'm overly optimistic and you don't share that gene.
No, I agree with what you're saying, even if I don't share that gene. I'm naturally pessimistic. Since I can remember, which sucks. It's not a pleasant mode of existence, but it is what it is.
Mm-hmm.
I totally agree. However, I want to add something.
Yeah.
In the movies and in the books, usually we have a villain.
Right.
With their army, who imposes evil and oppression on the good people, and the good people are together. Mm-hmm. And they are just suffering under the bolt of evil.
Right.
However, in the real world, the real evil and the real monsters live among the people which the hero tries to save.
Right.
And that's the bad thing in the Soviet Union. 95% of Moscow died in the concentration camps. 25%. A very small police force was able to kill 25% of people. How? Because they were traitors.
Yeah, they changed the whole culture, just like we're dealing with now in a different way.
Same thing happened in my country. And being a traitor would the proclivity to be a traitor, I think, has a strong biological component, which is genetic and can be inherited, because that's a niche within society. That's your way of extracting resources. There are many ways. You know, one way is to be a traitor. There is a way to be a victim, for example. By being a victim, you immediately are granted resources as reparations. You may be a hero. You may be someone who values hard work and so on. So there are different niches to extract resources from society. Now, if the traitor survived in larger numbers than the people who weren't traitors, their children are alive now and will do the same thing. And I think this is what we're seeing. This is what we saw last year. This is what we're seeing this year without getting into more specifics.
Yeah.
We don't see an evil force which is oppressing people. I just see that there are monsters within our ranks and the evil force is just seeing an opportunity. Even if you remove the evil force, the traitors are among us.
Well, the traitor is in every single one of us that would be a traitor to ourselves, our family, or the powers above, you know, the government, the authorities, whatever the case. So the difficult but necessary task is to figure out who to be a traitor against and who to never be a traitor against, and to recognize who the traitors are, which is everybody, but who is going to adhere to the higher values and who is going to descend to the weaker values, which is the vast majority of people. So it's not an easy task, but it is the task of humanity that we've been dealing with for known history, at least.
Well, as I said, in the fantasy books, you have people who have a sense of brotherhood, who love their kin.
Yeah.
And they are together and fighting against a singular oppressive force. In the real world, you fight against your own people who do not share these values, who do not care about their kin, who do not care about the group, who do not care about love, brotherhood, who do not care about your genetic pool. They just want to benefit themselves, and they are ready to give you in order to be rewarded resources. And I think that's the enemy, not some external force. Not any politician. Right. They are just managing the traitors within your population.
Right. Well, like I said, the traitors inside of all of us, and these, but the difference is who will attain to like the lower values of our lower instincts, our more selfish animal needs versus a more transcendent, higher value.
Well, it seems that it isn't in all of us. You've read Viktor Frankl. You've read probably Solzhenitsyn. Even under the most horrible, inhumane, unimaginably horrible evil and suffering and malevolence, and lack of hope, even in those conditions, some people went out of their way to help others. If, for example, giving them a piece of bread. You know, everybody is starving. Some people did that. And some people immediately started cooperating with the guards. So, you know, you read Franco, who were the worst people in the camps? Other inmates who were given power.
Right. I think, and I can't remember the exact way that he put it, but essentially,
anyone could go either way, including Frankel or Solzhenitsyn. You know, they could go that's the easier path, which is to descend into the muck and mire and the destructive path that most people went. But other people could have gone the transcendent or higher path, but didn't. So that's why it's like Solzhenitsyn says that the line between good and evil runs down the heart of every man. And it's because everyone could be that person that becomes a Auschwitz guard or, you know, Gulag Archipelago guard and gets high off that sort of power. Or they could be a person that helps to overcome. But of course, most people, and maybe it's again sort of like an evolutionary theory, most people just do the easier thing. But there's always at least some that do the higher thing. And that's why the higher truth or the true truth or the right things will always survive, but they'll always be under attack.
Yeah, totally. It makes sense. And yeah, we should strive to be these people if we think about those things at all.
Right. Whew. All right. We covered a lot. And
happy, positive discussions.
I think it is because it deals with reality and it deals with that there's always hope, but we have to go for it and not go for the illusions, because the illusions are... You know, like we didn't really get into the blame instinct, for example, in the book, but everyone just wants to like blame it on like, you know, Trump's the devil or this person or that person is the ultimate evil. And that gives them like energy and motivation to do certain things. But in reality, maybe the orange man isn't good. Maybe he's bad. But the reality is everybody has to deal with their own inner demons and inner devils, even if they don't believe in that, and it's just a psychological thing. Everyone has to deal with that. Mm-hmm. And the first step one of the first steps is to not take any of these easy illusions and deal with the reality for what it is. And then anyone who wants to do that can achieve those better things, those higher things. So I think it's a message of hope.
let's quote Peterson again.
Sure.
Put your house in perfect order before you go on to criticize the world.
Yep.
Yep. And let's add to that some humility.
Right.
That's very important. I don't see humility around. I see narcissism in their studies, actually showing that in the last several decades, two things happened. Empathy decreased among children.
Mm-hmm.
Empathy, so they are incapable of correctly identifying the emotions of and intentions of others.
Hmm.
The second thing which has been quantified is that narcissism has increased, probably due to social media, the likes, the stories, and everybody's like,
the duck face selfies.
Duck face, yes. And so we need to have some humility, and humility is pretty weird because nothing nurtures your humility. Everything nurtures your narcissism, especially among young girls with all those likes, and they're extremely arrogant. It's very difficult to speak with young women nowadays. It's very difficult to find humble young women. They are extremely arrogant. They have nothing beside. They achieved nothing. They have no skills. They have nothing. They are nothing. They only have the money of their parents. They
have or whatever guys give them or send them on OnlyFans or whatever.
Low testosterone simps, yes.
Yeah.
And they have nothing besides, they produce nothing. They're extremely arrogant.
They're parasites, but the worst part is they parasitize themselves. Because they have potential of course, because they've shown some signs of intelligence and sociability and things like that, but they just pour it all into vanity. And I've known a number of girls or heard a number of stories, even pre-pandemic, where girls seem super famous and happy and have like a million fans on Twitch or whatever else, and then commit suicide because, you know, they're not actually happy. That's not actually giving them any real meaning or purpose or anything like happiness.
Not only girls, the boys as well. And right. I see something very dangerous to the dangerous thing is that young people, since they lack humility,
right,
and they lack experience, they lack knowledge, they lack everything. So they are noobs. You're a complete noob who is confident, a confident noob. And they create non-government organizations and start pushing agendas. And so it's absurd. It's completely absurd. And I see this also among students. They start campaigning about things which they totally don't understand. And they are extremely confident. I know people who cannot pass their exams for the third or fourth time, but they have this sharp suit, and that guy, and that guy is, I would tell, that guy is at some organization and he's consultant about world peace.
Wow.
What? And you're in that guy's 20 years old.
It's like Greta it's like Greta Thunberg, her trying to tell the United Nations what to do about, you know, the emerging markets of India and their carbon responsibilities when she can't even finish high school.
Yeah, something like that. Now, I wanted to say is something about humility. When
you're right,
an intelligent person or any person actually, when any person tells you something which you don't know or which contradicts something which you already know, especially if that person tells you this in a non-aggressive way, as if they try to attempt to discuss something with you in order to reach the truth.
Right.
It pays to be humble because they may tell you something which you don't know.
Right.
But people do not want to find the truth. This is something which I've seen throughout the years. And this is why I rarely now engage in intellectual. I like intellectual discussions, but I hate discussing with intellectuals.
Right.
I can't stand intellectual type of self-proclaimed intellectuals. No, that those are the nastiest people. People do not want to find the truth. They do not care about the truth. They care to win. They care to be seen as knowledgeable.
Right.
So they engage in a discussion. They engage in arguing in order to win.
Well, yeah, to confirm their identity or espoused position or their ideology, which, by the way, gets a little bit into chapter 8, which is the single perspective instinct, and which is a very dangerous one that Hans Rosling and his son and daughter-in-law talk about in the book, that we have this instinct to only see things from our worldview, which is the stupidest thing we can do, because like a worldview doesn't even exist. You know, that's one thing that Olo Rosling said. It's just like this imaginary like fantasy world that we live in. That's our worldview. But since we have to have worldviews, the best thing to do is try to see the world as it really is from as many different worldviews as you can. Because if you only see it through your worldview will definitely be wrong, but you will be caught in this like needing your fantasy to be wrong because you're in this like frail, screwed up fantasy world, which is like what you were just saying.
And the best people which I met online through Facebook, you included, and the smartest people are pretty humble because each time they are presented with information which they don't know, their reaction is, can you tell me more?
Yeah.
And they start asking questions. Did I get it right? Is this what you mean? Can you share more information about that? Can you tell me how this fits with my current understanding? There are very few such people and I cherish them highly.
All right. Well, I don't know if we ended up in a optimistic or pessimistic place, but I like it because it's a reality place that we're hopefully getting people to, where we see human nature for what it is, and that it can be full of all these traps. But if we recognize the traps of this human nature that we have to live in, or the psychological nature that the world is, then we can not get trapped in it and not get destroyed by it or sucked into it, but rise above it and become heroes and make the world something like a better place. Dr. Ironbrain, do you have any closing thoughts?
2 + 2 = 4.
Okay, we went for 2 hours thinking we wouldn't get canceled, and you have to get us canceled at the last minute. All right, fine.
That you got the joke.
Yeah. Okay, it's just because you're an oppressive cisgender white male that you believe that, but that's okay.
I got labeled with many bad words lately from some of your fans who are probably listening right now.
Okay.
I just want to tell you, you know who I'm talking about. You're listening right now. I just want to tell you one thing, not you, but to the girl who is listening.
The girl. Okay.
I'm sending you a kiss, an ear kiss.
Okay.
Because I'm so bad.
You're such a bad boy with your patriarchal 2 + 2 = 4.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And anything as far as how people can find you on the internet, and I'll leave things in the show notes.
People can find me by you tagging me in the show, and my handle is visible on the screen at Dr. Ironbrain on all social media. I am very happy to engage with anyone who wishes to discuss anything.
And along these lines, you're finishing your dissertation right now, I believe. And how long until that's done, and then you'll have more time, or what's going on with that?
So we definitely do not finish on an optimistic note then.
Okay. I'm just thinking about your schedule, because I know you're busy for a little bit longer finishing that. So
crunching numbers trying to make sense of a huge statistical model. I have amazing colleagues who volunteered to help me with the complex statistical model. So I have to figure out a way to compensate them for their work and for their friendship, because that's a true hero. That's a true hero. That's true heroism. And the project is really interesting, which is worth a whole entire show, how the immune system of the brain influences its development, because I work with human tissues. This is why it's interesting. The brain has special immune system inside its own immune system, the microglial cells. I have a very interesting paper I wrote it some years ago, a hypothesis how the immune system of the brain can lead to the development of psychopathy, or to the change, or to differences in empathy and pro-social behavior between people. And there are some very interesting things there which are worth an entire discussion on their own.
Okay, so maybe when you get time again in the next few weeks, we'll talk about that and sex education.
Oh, sex education, yes. Evolutionary sexology, fetishes. Yeah. Why do we like big boobs? Why do some people like butts instead of boobs? Why do women wear makeup? Why are big dicks a thing and not small dicks? Why do these people develop that idea? Those are interesting discussions on their own.
All right. So we'll keep people thirsting for more. And we at the Daily Archetype really appreciate you coming on, and anybody who bothered to listen for over 2 hours. I hope it was interesting. And everybody take care and stay archetypal.
Yes, thank you. It was an honor to be on your show.
All right, take care.
Bye.
Bringing complex ideas down to earth based on their value, not group identity. This is the Daily Archetype.